The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for June 1st. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. And it is early Monday morning. We decided to record today. How was your weekend?
Oh, it was good. Yeah, Saturday was nice. And starting to get used to the dog. Been a month.
Yeah, a month old dog. Yeah. Puppy. So is it starting to, well, a month is not much to be trained, really.
But, yeah. Actually, you know, it's surprising what they can learn. I've actually been surprised how smart these dogs are. But yeah, I think in a couple of years, we'll probably have a really good dog.
Yeah. What kind is it again? It's a Labradoodle.
She's definitely not there yet. She's a Labradoodle. Yeah, but she does like learn commands already, which is surprising to me. I never trained a dog before, how fast they catch on.
Did you get stop barking?
No, she's actually not a huge barker. She does a ton of whining, though.
Yeah.
But no, it's going pretty well, actually. It's better than I expected.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Well, we'll have to give our listeners an ongoing update about your dog as it grows up.
Yeah, right. I'm starting evening training sessions now, so she's going to really get in shape. So what's new with you? I heard you got a new purchase.
I did. We bought electric bikes in my family.
Wow, that's pretty cool. You're the first person I know that has an electric bike.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I think this thing is a game changer. I really do. I mean, it's not as if electric bikes are anything new. They've been around for a while, but a couple things have really changed the game here. The mass production and the battery technology and the drive technology, much as in electric vehicles, has really taken root in the bike market. There's much more selection. And with the COVID crisis, what's happening is people are going out and buying bikes. And
really? Are the bike stores busy? I haven't been.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the bike shops are just killing it in terms of sales. There's just lineups and limited supply. But we were fortunate. I got the bike I wanted. It's a hybrid commuter mountain bike.
It does it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
A hybrid commuter mountain bike. So you're going to take an electric bike mountain biking like on the pass?
Oh, yeah. 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 You can. Yeah. I've got a regular mountain bike, which I thoroughly enjoy, but this is a hybrid mountain and you could use it as a commuter bike too.
Well, I guess so. Cause you got the electric. Doesn't matter how heavy it is. Right.
Yeah.
Good. So far you like it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you can get a good workout on these things. You just dial down the assist and you can either expend as much energy as you want from your regular muscles, or you can put it in turbo mode and really have a leisurely ride up a hill.
You know what? I think I could use that because I went down to Edworthy Park. For those that don't know, it's like a big hill down into the river valley. But the whole time you're going down, whole time you're thinking, God, I know I got to get back up this hill again. Well, with an electric bike, you wouldn't have that same
absolutely.
And sense of anxiety.
And I think this is where the game changer is. And we'll talk a little bit more about it later, because I think it is so important to understand this phenomena and what it means to the oil markets. Because I think that what's going on, not so much necessarily here, but in the Asian and European markets with electric bikes, is going to show up at the margins in terms of what it means to oil demand.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. But first, let's continue our discussion from last week. So we finished off our podcast last week talking about this large gap that will be left by the retreating U.S. and Canadian oil production, potentially 3 or 4 million barrels a day less supply by the end of 2021 due to COVID and the fact that we're not drilling very much. And we talked about without the market intervention, we think that gap will have to be filled by accepting oil from foreign suppliers. So countries maybe the U.S. doesn't want to be partners
sourcing with. Yeah, I think that this is a big issue. We're not talking about it much right now, given all that's going on. But give it 12 to 18 months when we start to see that all of a sudden the whole notion of energy independence, which led to energy dominance, is now retreating. And what we want to talk about today is, well, what does that imply 12 to 18 months out, both in terms of price, but more importantly, in terms of policy, which of course affects price?
It is actually fairly typical that governments do step in and think about energy security and put in policies and do things to try to reduce their dependence on foreign oil or oil that they see as less supply, less stable. So I wanted to talk about one of your Energy File vignettes called The Geopolitical Memoranda.
It's a little vignette. It's a book that was published in 1979 called The Secret History of the Oil Companies in the Middle East. It's actually the WikiLeaks of the day. It's a collection of memoranda published in a book from the 1940s, 1944, actually. And in 1944, we're toward the end of the World War II period. Oil is a very strategic military commodity. All countries are looking to get oil. And if you didn't have a state-owned oil company, you had, as a country, a series of oil companies that were really an adjunct to government. And there was policies in place in terms of how you thought about that strategic commodity. In the case of the United States, at the time, the way they were thinking about that commodity was that we need to find as much foreign oil as possible so that we use foreign oil first, and we need to keep our own domestic oil in reserve for a later date. So let's use everybody else's oil first, and we'll use ours last.
Well, and importantly, foreign oil that you control.
Yes.
So maybe some people don't know that Saudi Aramco stands for Saudi American Oil Company.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And BP, British Petroleum, was very active in Iran. And, you know, the British had control of those foreign oil reserves.
Yeah, that was called Anglo-Persian in the early days. So it was really the British, the Russians, and the Americans that were really big in the oil markets back in that era. And there was something called the Great Scramble to find oil resources all over the world and use them strategically to your own global advantage. So we'll come back to that, but it's important. Take a look at the vignette on the Energy File.
Mm-hmm. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Website, yeah.
So it's not new for the U.S. government or other countries to intervene when energy security is uncertain. So I wanted to go through some of the policies that are actually very recent that have been used in the U.S.
Yep.
And think about, do they work or not? And I think I'll be like, spoiler alert here. A lot of times government plans to do these things to reduce dependence on foreign oil or to get more security of supply don't tend to work because it's very difficult to work against market forces.
Well, and there's all the geopolitics of the world that just throw a curveball into things. So let's start.
Yeah. So very recent example is when Trump got in as president 4 years ago, one of the things he vowed to do was save the coal sector. Remember, like make coal great again.
Yeah. And that was in large part to keep the employment. But there was a energy security angle to that as well. Use our own resources, put our own people to work. So I think we can say that it's not a policy that has worked overly well.
No. In fact, there's been many U.S. coal companies go bankrupt. Some of the policies that Trump has implemented to help coal is he changed Obama's clean power plan, which would have phased out coal in power generation. So he got rid of that. He's also rolled back some of the environmental rules, which made it difficult to keep some of these coal power plants around. So he's released some of those. But still, the amount of power generated by coal keeps declining.
Yeah, I mean, this is a case where it's, you know, you remove all of the policy burdens off of the coal industry and it still can't compete with cheap natural gas and cheaper renewables, right? So the free market forces effectively trump, if you pardon the pun, the policies that were put in place to make coal competitive again. I don't really see coal coming back because natural gas, by and large, is going to be cheap going forward. Maybe not as cheap as it is today, but certainly cheaper than coal. And the renewables have come down dramatically. Energy storage is becoming more and more viable. So the days of coal are probably numbered. And there's not a lot of policy intervention you could do to keep coal viable going forward in North America.
Okay, next policy. This one I think there's a lot of learnings from is the biofuels mandate. So back in 2005, President Bush put it the first biofuels mandate. And then in 2007, he expanded it in a law called the Energy Independence and Security Act. And they basically mandated a certain schedule where there would be so much biofuels added each year. But they didn't even just mandate biofuels in general. They mandated a new cellulosic biofuels, which didn't even exist because they recognized that you didn't want it all to come from food sources like corn and that there would be only so much agricultural land and you didn't want to take away from growing food. So they said, well, a certain fraction of it, quite a large fraction as time went on, needed to come from this new way of doing it, which would take strong fibers of plants such as grass, wood, or algae, so non-food sources, and create ethanol from that.
Yeah.
But it didn't exist commercially. No one knew how to do it economically.
Yeah.
But they put it into law. And it was a very short time period that over a decade, it would really ramp up and become a large part of U.S. oil supply. So it did work in that they did grow biofuel from 0.3 million barrels a day in 2006 in the U.S. to over a million barrels a day, but it all was corn because they never really figured out how to do the non-food type.
Yeah, so if you look at that 0.3 to 1 million barrels per day substituting the American oil market, it's not really very much. I mean, what did the American...
It's about 19 million barrels a day.
19 million barrels a day. So you went and substituted out 700,000 of it with an increased production of the biofuels. This is an important lesson because if we wind our minds back to that 2005, 2007, that was when the Iraq war was going on. It was the period where energy security was a big issue. The ability of the United States to be able to supply its own consumption was on a steady decline. The worries about American dependency were ramping up and up as the Middle Eastern geopolitics were taking root. So President Bush came in. First of all, he said, we are addicted to oil. We need to do something. So the big push went on biofuels at the time, bioethanol and so on. And as you said, the cellulosic was too expensive at the time.
Well, there was also a greenhouse gas debate about it because it was basically, if you're going to take all this agricultural land and grow corn for fuel, then we're going to have to knock over forests somewhere else and create more land for agriculture. And so when you considered the land use effects, some people said, you know, it made it worse than petroleum.
The land use, the extra fertilizers, the pesticides, the herbicides, and all in, and most importantly, the realization that the technology wasn't there to compete with the incumbent, which was the petroleum products, right? At the end of the day, the fuel that came out of whatever bioprocess could not compete with what was a gallon of gasoline, basically.
Yeah, well, and there was actually some logistical issues that the law never thought about. So existing cars that we have today are limited to 10% ethanol. If you go more than that, there can actually be corrosion in the tanks and the pipes. There were cars that came out that could take a lot more ethanol, but most owners didn't know that. And also the fuel distribution system would have to be completely rebuilt because the tanks and the pumps would all be need to be new to take the ethanol. And so basically, you know, none of the retail network was willing to make the changes. Yeah. The car manufacturers, some of them put in the cars that could take more ethanol, but not everyone did it. And so basically there was these logistical constraints. Yeah, you made a law that says we want to ramp up ethanol by a certain amount, but you forgot that there's other pieces to the supply chain that need to be changed, and you didn't put in the policies for that as well.
So in summary, the strategy of trying to displace foreign oil with an alternative fuel that was domestically produced, in this case from agricultural products, was not successful.
No, because you can't really just mandate, the government can't come in and say, I'm going to mandate innovation. We don't have a process to make this economically, but I'm going to say in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to ramp it up to a certain level. You know, that just isn't how it works,
right? No.
Like the innovation didn't happen. You can't have innovation by edict. And then the other thing is they didn't think about supply chain issues and think about the policy needed to support that.
There were supply chain issues. I think the biggest issues with biofuels, because we're still talking about biofuels, is just scale. I mean, you just need so much scale to displace the status quo in the United States alone, 19 million barrels per day, that it's just not easy to do with agricultural products or even other kinds of technologies.
Yeah. So I do not expect, you know, we're bring this forward to today. If the U.S. is now importing 3 million barrels a day from overseas more than they used to, I don't think they'll go down the road of biofuels.
Yeah, I think that's the key point to be made here.
Yeah. Okay, so here's another one that could work. Banning imports of foreign crude oil. So what you do is say, or you put a tariff on those imports of foreign crude oil so they're not as economic. So this would be effective, but it would be costly to the U.S. economy and the consumer. And we actually wrote a commentary not too long ago, which I'll put a link to, what if the U.S. slapped tariffs on oil imports. Just to put some numbers in perspective, in 2019, the U.S. imported about 3 million barrels a day of oil from overseas. But at the same time, they exported almost that same amount of their own domestic oil to markets beyond the U.S.
So it's net zero.
Yeah, exactly. They're actually, they're independent in terms of their oil production from a net basis, but they're actually still dependent on these overseas oils. And why do they still have bring in that oil if they have it domestically?
Well, because it's a global market. There's different grades of oils, different kinds of petroleum markets. It's a global exchange. But in the event of crisis and I'll call it challenges to your energy security, at least there's a comfort in knowing that you produce as much as you consume.
That's right. Like if the price of oil goes skyrocketing up to some huge number, you know, your balance of payments is still good, right? You're exporting a product at that high price and you're importing it. The issue, though, if you said no more of that, is those U.S. refiners were set up to consume a diet of the offshore crudes, which are not exactly the same as the crudes here. So there would be a ton of capital investment needed by the refineries to change their refineries so that they could consume more domestic crude. In the meantime, they would be forced to still bring in that overseas crude. There'd probably be a tariff on it. So it would be a lot more expensive for the U.S. refiners.
Yeah, this is a problematic thing. And I know that there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in the notion of putting big high tariffs on foreign crude to keep foreign crude out to sustain the domestic industry, not only for the purpose of employment, but just energy security overall. However, it's fraught with complications and potential unintended consequences. The pervasive notion is that all oil is the same, all petroleum products are the same, but they're not. And refineries are finely tuned to take certain grades of oil. So if you have contracts to bring in foreign oil into a refinery, then your refinery is typically tuned to that foreign oil.
And it'll take billions of dollars of investment to change that. And for sure, it would help the domestic producers because once you put that tariff on, that would kind of set the price domestically.
Right.
You know, the domestic crudes could sell for very close to the price of imported oil plus the tariff. So it would drive up domestic production. But the problem is the refiners would have to pay a lot. And, you know, it's not just the refiners. That would get passed on to the consumers. Right. So U.S. consumers would be paying a lot more for gasoline at the pump to compensate for having to bring in these foreign oil that are worth a lot more now and the capital cost of the refineries. So not surprisingly, this has been talked about the last few months, U.S. refiners are very concerned and their trade group in Washington has been lobbying the White House to resist pressure for tariffs on crude imports, trying to educate them that this in the end would cost the American people a lot more.
I think there's a psychology, and maybe it's beyond psychology, the reality that if you put tariffs on in the United States, then you are at a competitive disadvantage to other countries that are accessing foreign oil that is cheaper, right? And so there is a economic competitiveness argument to be made there.
This one, not a good idea. It might be good in the short term because right away you'd see those foreign oils not coming in. But in the long term, it would hurt the economy and we wouldn't be as productive as we would be if we didn't have these types of policies.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a feel-good kind of policy to think that, okay, we're shutting out the foreign oils. But practically, it's fraught with all sorts of unintended consequences that we don't know where it would take us, to be honest.
Okay, so the next one is actually the only one I've found that I think would work, which is increase efficiency. And this was actually used effectively in the 1970s after the oil price shocks to reduce U.S. dependence on foreign oil. We were able to travel further on the same amount of oil. So that worked because that brought down the use over time of how much oil that you consumed in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense in terms of trying to figure out how to use less, which is a virtuous thing, in my opinion, anyway. The challenge that we've seen over the last 30 years or so is that for every gain in fuel economy, the gain has been partially, and in some instances, fully offset by people buying bigger and heavier vehicles.
Right. Yes, so that isn't changed.
I mean, this is the problem with energy efficiency in general.
The difference is, though, with these mandates, the automakers have to put out a fleet of vehicles that meets them. So you kind of put the onus on the automakers to try to entice people to buy some of the smaller vehicles so that they can keep their average that they sell within this rule. And I just wanted to talk quickly about Obama, who introduced a significant improvements in 2011. His goal was a 50% improvement between when he introduced the policy in 2025. If he had done that, it would have saved 2 million barrels a day by 2025. Now, Trump actually rolled back those requirements. He's still putting in some efficiency gains, but not nearly as aggressive as what Obama had in place.
Right.
But if we go back to that number that the U.S. could be reliant on 3 million barrels a day, let's say, more imports than they are today, you know, energy efficiency, it takes some time. You don't change the auto fleet overnight.
Okay. No.
And it would take very strict policies. And I don't know how those car companies entice people to buy the smaller cars, because the reality is people are buying bigger cars all the time.
Yeah.
But they would have to somehow entice people so that their average would be there. Then you could actually get the fuel efficiency making the difference here. But it takes about 10 years to kind of see a total impact, even 15 of those economy changes on the entire fleet, because you've got to wait for the old cars to be retired.
Yeah.
So this one would work.
Yeah, it would work if you can make the system from well to wheels more efficient and you don't abuse it by cannibalizing the efficiency gains in some other way.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about electric cars, because actually to meet Obama's plan, the automakers would have had to introduce a certain amount of electric to get their average fleet fuel efficiency into that range. So you could encourage electric. Now, we often think about electric cars, but you got me thinking, well, maybe they could encourage smaller things like electric bikes too. And I know in Europe and other places, we're starting to see a lot more e-bikes replace the need for car transport.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think this is a key, and this is how we started out the conversation, and certainly has got me thinking. They said electric bikes are nothing new, but what's happening with this surge in e-bike purchases, especially in Asia and Europe, where you're seeing, you know, 200%, in other words, a doubling of sales just in the last few months as a consequence of COVID. But I think there's more to the story. I think it is of the fact that the e-bikes are becoming better and better and the price point is falling, certainly cheaper than an electric vehicle. You don't have to rewire your home. You can just plug it in. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a mild digression, solar panels on your roof is insufficient to charge an electric vehicle battery. It is sufficient if you want to charge your bike.
So, right, so it could be zero emissions.
Because you're not, I mean, with an electric vehicle, you're trying to haul around, you know, 1,500 kilos or something like that. With a bike, it's just a fraction of that. So the energy to carry around a whole bunch of battery and metal is not required. So what we're seeing, though, more importantly, as a consequence of the COVID crisis, is some of these big cities like Paris, Brussels, and even some in the United States are blocking off entire roads or part of major roadways. In Paris, I think it's several hundred kilometers of urban roadways are being blocked off for the use by bicycles. So what you're doing is you're now creating the infrastructure, which is being built as temporary at the moment. But I think there's a high probability that some of this temporary bike lane infrastructure is going to go permanent, because the more people that buy bikes and you demonstrate that the model works, I think the less chance that they're going to take down the temporary bike lanes. And, you know, this is not just something that we think about here, because it's not necessarily happening as much in our own backyard, but on the other side of the world where the oil consumption is still quite significant, it can make a big difference at the margins.
Yeah, and I think another big trend is if people aren't going to get back into the subways in these cities, it's like totally impossible for everyone to be in their cars, and people cannot move around these cities. And so I think from that perspective, if people stay out of the subways, out of the public transportation, this is the only thing that's going to work in dense cities.
Yeah.
And also we need those roadways to be used for people, because you can't social distance on those tiny little sidewalks. Think of a city like New York or Paris. You can't stay 2 meters away from everyone that's trying to get down the sidewalk. So I think this is all good. My only concern is winter. This sounds great in this time of year, but in Europe, winter comes, and I'm not sure it'll be quite as good to be commuting by bike at that point.
No, I mean, if you've been to Amsterdam, Copenhagen, okay, they don't necessarily get as cold as you do in Canada because they're by a coast, but it gets pretty cool. And I mean, the number of bikes, even before this bike craze that we're seeing now, is really substantial.
Well, and I guess the thing is, if the alternative is public transportation,
which
you're not comfortable with.
No, you're not comfortable with.
And then the other alternative is a car, but you can't really move around in a car because the cities are too congested now because there aren't enough roadways. So we'll wait and see. Now, the other policy that's been implemented already to try to get more electric technology in is obviously giving subsidies for people that buy electric cars. And that has been not all that successful. There's been major subsidies in the U.S. In fact, in some states, you could be between the federal tax break and the state level rebate, you could be getting like $10,000 off your car, the initial capital cost, but you're not seeing them really take off, with the exception of Tesla, which is, you know, isn't even getting those rebates anymore. People are buying them because they like the cars. In Canada, I'm sure many of you know that our federal government will offer a $5,000 incentive. And then in some provinces like BC, you can get another incentive. So you can get a fair amount off, but it's really not enough to tip the scales for these lower cost cars, because they're, for example, a Leaf is about twice the price an electric Leaf is about twice the price of a comparable combustion engine. And so that capital cost difference isn't really enough for most people to go that direction.
No, the costs of these are still on the high side, and the adoption rate is going to be probably now slower than expected pre-COVID because they're big capital outlays, subsidy or no subsidy. And I don't think basically people don't have enough money to be thinking about buying a new car. We saw after the financial crisis a decade ago that it took 2 or 3 years for the car market to recover for people to start thinking about replacing their cars. So to me, it's not, from a policy perspective, it's not something that's going to kickstart and displace oil consumption quickly anytime soon.
Yeah. I mean, there's other policy I think that's even more impactful than taking money off, which is giving better treatment to people with electric cars. For example, in some cities in the U.S., like in California, you can gain access to carpool lanes when there's just one person in the car.
Yeah.
You can park in better places. In places like in Asia, where you're only allowed to use your car every other day, the electric cars are being able to use every day. So I think those kind of incentives in congested cities can work better than
they are.
Rebates.
But let's bring this first full circle. The objective that we're trying to understand is how to become more energy independent, energy secure, at a time when we look forward and see that North America, so Canada plus the U.S. especially, oil production is set to come off fairly heavily. And that is going to pose potentially some policy issues. So where would you put your money? Shall I just summarize?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in terms of policy and strategies, the first one we talked about was get rid of environmental policies and other barriers. That was the coal example. I don't think that that particularly would be effective on the oil side. And I don't think it would be politically palatable either. The second alternative is alternative fuels, especially biofuels. And that doesn't look like it's of sufficient scale. And it's also fraught with competitive problems.
Right? Yep. It didn't work.
Number three is, okay, let's aggressively institute policies that would make vehicle mobility, I'll call it in broad sense, more efficient.
Yeah, efficiency, which is the only policy that really worked. And it worked back in the late 70s to 80s. So we know it worked.
Right. But you would have to ensure that for every gain in efficiency, it isn't offset by, you know, some other factor that would make you consume just as much or more.
Right. You just go get a more efficient, larger car.
And then the last one is alternative mobility. We concluded by talking about electric vehicles, the cars, which I still think is slow. We just talked about that. And then there's this curious phenomenon of the e-bikes, which has suddenly started to take off with no policy. And that's what I love, is no policy, no government intervention, and all of a sudden you are transitioning to something. Now, I'm not saying that e-bikes are going to replace everything, not at all. But in terms of taking the edge off of global oil consumption in the mobility market, which is about, 40% of the barrel?
That's right, yeah.
I think that there's something happening here that could be potentially consequential.
That's a great summary. Now, there's a couple of things we didn't have time to talk about on today's podcast. One is obviously a carbon tax, which is a government policy that could bring down the use of oil by increasing its price.
Yeah, I mean, the fastest way to reduce consumption is to raise its price. And a carbon tax would do that, or any kind of tax on the fuel under consideration. So I think that we need to talk about that at a later podcast, because this carbon tax is obviously a whole subject onto its own and deserves an entire 30 minutes. But there's also, we didn't talk about the Zoom and the commuting alterations that could happen. In other words, non-physical commuting and no bike, no car, just stay at home.
Just stay at home, right, which isn't really a government policy. It may just be like what companies decide to do.
That's
but you're right, that could have a big impact. You know, if it takes off in the U.S. and reduce the need for oil and then offset that need for foreign oil. So there's lots of other factors. And, you know, even with that carbon tax, we really focused on car efficiencies.
Yeah.
But there's efficiencies through a carbon tax that could come for semi-trucks, for all uses of oil. So
you
can have a much broader impact.
Yeah. So I think both those things, the carbon tax has said deserves its own. The Zoom thing, I think I want to let it play out a little bit more for another couple months post pandemic to see where we're at and how companies are going to react and what the commuting situation looks like.
Okay, well, we'll visit that on a future podcast.
Okay.
With that, we'll wrap up the podcast. If you liked it, rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.